This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
All right. Bob Mata, defense attorney. And as you also may know, he's got the podcast Buried, all about John Wayne Gacy, all about the cassette tapes that he received from his father, who was one of Gacy's attorneys. And on those cassette tapes, the words of John, things people had never heard before, never will again, things about the case that were never even part of the trial. There's so many interesting nuggets in this podcast. If you're a fan of Gacy, but if you're interested in the case, it is certainly definitely worth checking out, especially if you just got a chance to watch Devil in Disguise or have seen the doc or the series out on Peacock right now. And incidentally, Bob is with us along with Stacey Cole and Todd Michaels. Bob, welcome. We've been talking about doing this for a while now, talking about the Gacy tapes. And why not now more than ever with everybody buzzing about it? For those who don't know, just kind of give us a little backstory on you getting a hold of these tapes from your dad. How did this all go down?
So my dad, back in 79 and 80, was one of Gacy's two trial attorneys. So Sam Amaranti, who had done other work that wasn't related to crimes for Gacy and his contracting business, put together little contracts for him. You know, if there were little people in terms of small claims stuff that weren't paying him, he'd file suit for him. So they had a relationship, a business relationship prior to the shit going down with Gacy. So when they start tailing Gacy in 1978 in December, he ends up reaching out to Sam and he's like, "Hey, Sam, you know, these fucking cops, man, they're following me around. They've been doing it for like a week. Is there like anything we can do about it?" And Sam's like, at that point, Sam had left the public defender's office and hung his own shingle. Okay. Like pretty recently. And Sam wasn't as, he wasn't as long in the tooth in terms of trying criminal cases as my father was. So when Sam kind of gets involved, no one knows at that point that Gacy's the monster that he is. Mm-hmm. Like, he's just like, they're saying that I kidnapped this fucking kid and I didn't do it. And they're following me around 24/7. They're sitting on my house. They're following me into restaurants, you know, help me. So Sam ultimately goes and talks to Terry Sullivan, who's the prosecutor in Rolling Meadows, which is the third district up in that area where Gacy lived. And he is saying, "What's going on, man? Like, why are you tailing this guy? You guys already did a search of his house on the 13th of December. You didn't find shit. Like, why are you hounding my client?" And they're like, "Because we think he did it. Like, he's the last person that the kid said he was going to talk to, and he vanished off the face of the earth. We're going to keep following him. We're not stopping the tail." Sam's like, "Okay, fuck you. I'm filing a TRO." So as you're leading into that following Monday, Sam at that point is getting panicked because the case breaks on the 12th. I had flown in. My parents were divorced. It was winter break. I'm sitting in my dad's living room with my father and my uncle when the story breaks on the news, 10 o'clock news in Chicago. They're going through. They've got the camera trained on the house. They show the first remains being brought out of the house. They're like, "Oh, my God, there's a house here in unincorporated Norridge. It appears that they're removing remains from the house." The media has no idea what's going on. The Robert Peace story wasn't like a big deal in the media at that point in terms of the abduction and the fact that he disappeared, because that's how they treated missing kids back in the 70s, man. It wasn't news, until it became a thing. So at some point during the evening, as this breaking story, they continue to cover it. Sam, who is unmistakable because he's like 5'3", 5'4", he's a very short guy, Sam comes on camera for a short interview. And my dad's like, holy shit, it's Sam. I know Sam. And so my dad's like, and again, at this point, we have no idea what kind of monster Gacy is, right?
Sure. It's just another news story.
Another news story. Potentially, this guy had a body in his house. So, like, he's good for one thing. At least it looks like. So my dad, so as it progresses, and they, I think that first night they pull out two of the victims' remains that night, okay? Because it's dark out. The crawl space is maybe 2.5 feet clearance. It's very difficult to be down in there. It's obviously pitch black. There is no smell, which is something that we'll get into later. But, you know, because most of these remains are skeletal that they end up finding, if not all of them. And there had been 900 pounds of lime that had been spread out in that crawl space in June of that year of 78. So there was no rotting flesh smell, okay? Mm-hmm. Which is an important thing that I want you to remember when we get to the second warrant.
Okay. But
at any rate, my old man, to answer your question, says, should I send a Western Union to Sam to see if he needs help on the case? And I'm 10 and I'm like, yeah, dad. I'm like, you'll be on the news. You know, yeah, that's how, you know, I don't know. I don't know shit from shit. I'm 10, you know? So, and my father for all the years after, he's like always kind of blamed me for him being out there. He's like, yeah, you know, Bob, you really encouraged me. So needless to say, the following day, my father goes out because this is obviously pre-cell phone, pre-internet, pre-email, pre-fax, all pre-everything. Goes out and sends Sam a Western Union. Now, if you watch it on Peacock, that was one of the things that they fictionalized where they had Sam on the phone calling lawyer after lawyer after lawyer after lawyer, and every lawyer's like, no. My dad is like, as soon as that story broke the following day, sent the Western Union telegram to Sam. Sam calls him back immediately. He's like, yes, I need help. When that call takes place, my father had also just hung his shingle, left the public defender's office, except Sam was in the third district up in Rolling Meadows, which is a suburban. You're not dealing with the kind of shit that you deal with in the House of Pain, which is 26 and Cal in Chicago. That's where my father was the lead felony private or public defender. So my father was very seasoned litigator, was a phenomenal attorney. And Sam was all about him coming on board because Sam needed the help. And again, even at this point, they still have no idea what they're dealing with. Like they, like at this point, maybe they have three bodies because they're uncovering them in the crawl space. It takes a lot of time. They're going slowly. They're, you know, you have body on top of body. So you have bones that are laying on top of bones and you're dealing with this concept of at some point being able to try to identify these victims where we don't have DNA at that point where you have basically medical records, dental records. And if the kids were wearing something unique, a belt buckle, a necklace that somebody had given them. So they're trying to be as careful as they can when they're removing these bodies, understanding, you know, the medical examiner there is really overseeing everything. So they're being very, very methodical about trying to get the remains out. So Sam calls my dad after he gets the Western Union and my father like freaks out, like kind of like he's like he gets nervous about it. And he initially says, well, he's like, you know what? I've got a bunch of stuff going on. Like I've got other cases I got to handle. I don't think I could do it. And he hangs up the phone, sits back in his chair. And this is all gospel. This is all true. None of this is fictionalized.
Sure.
Thinks about it for like about 10 minutes, picks the phone back up and he tells Sam, all right, yeah, I'll do it. And so Sam tells my dad, the first thing I need you to do is you need to file a motion in the court to get them to quit calling Gacy crazy on the news. And my dad says, well, Sam, there's this little thing called the First Amendment. They're going to be allowed to say whatever. There's nothing that I can file that's going to be able to stop them in terms of what they're going to say while they're doing the investigation. Because at that point, the thought of a gag wasn't even a thing, you know, really. So my dad writes up whatever he can, files it. And from there on, you know, the case just starts growing bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's like, just like this nightmarish case. And they realize very, very early that this is going to be an insanity defense case, you know, because of the fact that Gacy, as soon as he's taken into custody, with Amaranti not being with him in the initial hours, even though he was retained, I'm a little bit tough on Sam in my podcast, and I get progressively tougher on him from a defense attorney's perspective, looking objectively at the handling of the case in the early days, you know, that he wasn't there and for the initial interrogation and confessions by Gacy, wherein he made some admissions purportedly, because none of the interrogations were videotaped. None of them were handwritten confessions from Gacy and signed. They were all based on a report written by Mike Albrecht, who was the one that was conducting the interrogation. Now, on my podcast, Mike was the second cop who I interviewed, and I love Mike Albrecht. Like, all of these old Des Plaines cops were salt of the earth, good guys, and exceptionally honest about the faults of the department and policing back in the 70s and how they just were disregarding missing kids and just, you know, chalking it off to them moving out to California, and, you know, or if it was had anything to do with, you know, in their estimation, homosexuality, and the kids would be, you know, they're gay. It was a gay fight. We don't give a shit about that. Or it was socioeconomic in the sense that these aren't folks with money, so we're just not going to put the resources in it because we don't care. Like, those types of things were real, and it was taking place, and it went on for years, which is what allowed Gacy to continue to operate, because there's a misnomer that Gacy was under the radar. Multiple people had gone in, because as we had Patrick McManus on, along with Michael Chernus on your show last week, and he was talking about this fact that, you know, there were thousands. Gacy hooked up with thousands of guys. It was like, this dude was a disgusting apex predator machine that would just go out and just could not get enough. He was a glutton, like a sex addict, like everything. He just had to have more of everything. And, you know, a lot of these kids survived. So you had a lot of survivors. You have the Jeff Rignall, who was kept hostage for 2 days in Gacy's shed, being tortured and, you know, repeatedly chloroformed and made to be knocked out while he's passed out. They're sexually abusing him. And he goes into the cops and they're like, how are we going to find this guy? So Jeff Rignall goes and sits on an overpass for a week and waits, because he knows what Gacy's car looks like, waits literally for this car to drive by. And then one day, unbelievably, it does. And he runs back to the police station with the plates. Says, here's the fucking plate for the guy that just nearly killed me and completely tortured me for 2 days. They end up charging Gacy on that case with simple assault. Just to let you know where the mindset of Chicago police was at that time.
If they had made a different decision at that point.
And Rignall was late. Like, if you listen to my episode 3, which I'm not going to give any spoilers, I go through... I implore everybody, don't skip right to it. Listen from the beginning. But episode 3 lays it out. They should have had Gacy under arrest by Robert, by the third victim, John Bukovich. They had everything they needed. Any competent cop, had they followed through with any kind of investigation, would have had Gacy dead to rights. They would have gotten a warrant. They would have gotten into that house. They would have gotten into the shed. His father, and I'll talk about Johnny Bukovich, called the Chicago police every week for 2 years, begging them to look at John Bukovich's boss. Because that's the other thing with Gacy, is that the way that they tried to portray it initially in the press through the words of law enforcement, that these were all wayward kids, that they were all street hustlers, that they were all, you know, out there selling themselves for money and hustling. And that's just not true. Plenty of Gacy's victims were young men that were just trying to work and make a living in a very difficult economic time, making $5 an hour because Gacy paid better than most. And he always had a type. He'd always hire his type in terms of the kids that were doing the contracting work for him. And John Bukovich was one of those kids. And man, it was unbelievable. And you know, like I'm going to let you ask me questions because I can go on.
I mean, it's amazing what, you know, just we look at policing today and we get very upset all the time at various things that seem to be falling through the cracks. You know, like the Aaron Spencer case, we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But what was able to go on, what was able to thrive back then, I think our minds would be blown today if it was going on like that. But because of the world that we lived in and the lack of technology, the lack of modern policing, the lack of more efficient ways of doing things, people like Gacy were allowed to thrive in ways that I don't know that we're ever going to see another Gacy again, simply because our world has changed so much. What do you think about that?
It's odd that you say that. So in the epilogue, which is the final thing after our final episode, which is 33 plus 3, because we wanted to memorialize the victims, which there were 33 that we know of. Happen to believe that there's additional victims, because that's another part of the investigation that we'll talk about in a second. That just did not happen. But the last episode, it's me and my producer who was doing this boots on the ground investigation with me. We had that exact conversation. If Gacy were operating in today's time with the technology and everything that exists in the world that we live in, how many do you think that he would have gotten away with? And, you know, I was at like 2, maybe 3. If he's really focusing on people that are off the grid, you know, if you've got one kid whose family is all over it and who is up law enforcement's ass, like Miss Peast, who was Gacy's last victim, she was all over them. And she's like, my son didn't fucking run away. Don't you dare tell me my son ran away. He's a honor roll student. It's my birthday. My son would never do that. Something has happened to him. Fucking find my kid. And they did, you know. So if you had a parent like that and with an Amber Alert, because even if you're 16, 17, you go missing, there's an Amber Alert. They're going to be getting Gacy's phone. Like he just wouldn't have been able to get away with it. It wouldn't happen. It's like in our world now, to me, the only serial killers that can really succeed, for lack of a better term, in terms of having some kind of longevity in what they're doing, are probably truck drivers, over the road truck drivers that are constantly on the move, and people that commit these crimes in national parks, just because it's so off the grid. I mean, you have to be off the grid.
Yeah.
No, and even in those circumstances, you know, it's difficult if people are like, okay, well, my husband or my significant other or my son went hiking and now they're gone. Just the vast amount of land that has to be covered in order to discover the bodies takes forever. And sometimes they never find these folks. And you have to be able to find the body to know if that something criminal took place, that somebody was murdered, that it wasn't just an accident and somebody fell or what have you, or was, you know, there was predation, an animal, whatever. You know, you have to know that a crime was committed before you're going to get the cops to investigate it. So, like, in those two circumstances, I can see in which, you know, that's kind of how Israel Keyes was able to kind of continue his, and we don't really even know how many he killed. You know, my buddy Josh Hallmark has a great podcast about him, and he's been just digging into that thing, that case, Israel Keyes, who's now dead, who killed himself when he was in jail. You know, he's been really trying to uncover how many victims just that guy was accountable for. And it's one of those things, like he was a national parks, near bodies of water type dude. So I think in this day and age, it's awfully tough for those guys to operate. Thankfully.
Stacey, your mic's muted. I thought she was.
Sorry.
Looks like I'm sure.
Is that better?
Go ahead.
I had a little technical issue there for a second.
Go ahead.
Do we think that there's about 8 to 10 victims still unidentified at this point? Is that the number that they have?
There's right five. Now? Five unidentified victims.
Five. So okay.
I was in the middle of the investigation and doing the podcast, and they identified Francis Alexander, which he either, so there were six at that point. And through they used DNA Doe was the agency that was able to use IgG to be able to figure out who that was. They had submitted DNA from, I believe it was a jawbone, and they were able to develop a profile from it. From that profile, they then went in to use genealogical DNA in terms of using family trees to look back, find somebody that was somewhere on one of the databases, whether it be 23andMe or Ancestry.com, mm-hmm. any of the private databases that allow people to allow their profiles to be shared in order to try to help
sure.
missing cases and, you know, unidentified victims and John and Jane Doe's. So they were able to put that together. And then they had to put Francis in the city of Chicago, which they were able to do, I believe, with a parking ticket. So they knew that he was in and around the area at that time. So that process, and you know, I was relentless with Jason Moran, who was heading that part of the investigation, as there's still these 40 years later, with all that we have developed in terms of technology and DNA technology specifically, and especially with labs like Othram Labs. You know, I was all over Jason Moran, who works with the Cook County Sheriff's Police. I'm like, what the fuck are you waiting for? I'm like, just get whatever you have over to Othram and let them develop profiles. Let's get these kids their names back. Let's give these families some type of closure. Like, why aren't you doing it? And it's still my pod. I originally released it prior to. It's been 3+ years. Yeah. So, you know, it's inexplicable to me why that work's not being done, why the remains aren't in the hands of labs across this country that are going to be able to develop profiles from it, even after all these years.
But that problem exists well beyond just the Gacy case here, obviously. There's countless cases where there's evidence just sitting, waiting for these sort of tests to be done. Does it come down to manpower? Does it come down to money? Does it come down to interest to the families, especially in cases, you know, 40 plus years old of people still being alive, of there being parents or siblings or someone that was closely connected to some of these victims that are still around, that are even aware that you can do these sort of things, that are pushing for these sort of tests to be done?
Yeah, I think all of those things are a factor, you know, truly. I mean, some of the kids might not even be in Namus. Some of the kids may not have been ever reported as missing, so they're not in the database, you know. And as far as the funding part of it goes, in this day and age with crowdsource funding, I believe that we'd be able to raise the capital for any type of case that would be required to get the lab to be able to do the work. I mean, I had David Middleman on our show a couple of months ago, and, you know, he's like, I never worry about the money side of it. Like, with crowdfunding, we'll be able to get the money, which I believe is 100% true. So, you know, but like all those things that you stated are impediments, you know, those are all things that create issues in terms of being able to get these missing persons identified. We're seeing incredible things, though. You know, you see it on a daily basis, like DNA Doe Project. I always get emails when I've identified somebody that's been missing or, you know, for 30, 40 years. I mean, Othram has identified John and Jane Doe's that were 90-100 years missing. You know, it's incredible stuff, man. It's like there is no time limit in terms of how far back they can go. And then, you know, DNA is such a fascinating area of science, in that, you know, we share, males share their YSTR chromosome with all of our ancestors, you know, and it mutates slightly, but it's close enough to where it's going to lead them to the right, like on the right path. And that's where IgG comes in. And that's where that, you know, that family tree thing looks at it. And they're going to be able to say, okay, well, somebody uploaded their DNA here, and this person is a pretty close match, if not exactly. And so now let's work our way back, looking through that family tree, and figure out exactly who this person is. And that can be communicating with the people that uploaded the DNA profile and say, hey, you know, tell us who's in your family. Because, you know, obviously a lot of people don't do 23andMe or Ancestry.com. They don't get their DNA on profile. So you've got to do a lot of that manual legwork. But with AI,
I feel like we're on the cusp of like quite an amazing thing that's about to happen. And I'm wondering how many people out there, and number one, you're going to have a lot of families that are going to get answers to some of their questions. But I think you're also going to get families are going to get answers to their questions too in a different way of, oh, remember Weird Uncle Charlie?
Yep. Like, that's right.
Yeah. Like that's it's right. Not always just going to be connecting those dots. It's going to be, oh God. Yeah, yes. There was a reason he was weird. He was doing this over there. Stacey, what are we looking at in the comments right now? What are some people asking about?
Yeah, Mark had a really good question. What other states do you think Gacy had killed in?
Wisconsin. Ew. Definitely. Yeah, I think.
Well, he's right there.
I know, but still. Like, come on.
He used to go up there very, very frequently. And there's a property that we know that he frequented that we at one point believed that Gacy had owned property up in Wisconsin. Yeah, because, I mean, it's a short drive. I mean, for us in Illinois, when we want to get away, that's where we go. You know, we
and
go
then everybody in Wisconsin.
You fibbers.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just going to go there.
And to be honest with you, Mark, he traveled so much for work. It really requires a more in-depth investigation in terms of people that went missing at times that we know Gacy was in different states. Now, the one thing that you kind of like causes you some pause in terms of whether or not he was active when he was on the road is, you know, by way of him having this graveyard under his house, that wasn't him being clever. That was him being lazy, you know, and it just worked out for him that, look, I was able to have this graveyard under here and it kept me off the radar until he ran out of room.
If he had had a bigger house, he may have had more victims.
Excuse me. Yeah, exactly. Well, ultimately the last five were dumped in the Des Plaines River when he ran out of room. So, I mean, we have all of his work records because he kept impeccable work records. So we know where he traveled. He was in Kansas City. He was all over the Midwest.
Yeah.
All the time. We were chasing lead down in Florida because we know that he was down in Florida at a time that a kid that was in the military went missing off the base. And he was down there around that time. I had done FOIA requests because that's the other part for us. Season one really was an examination of the failures of Chicago police and how Des Plaines was able to get this done in 10 days. I wanted to know why the fuck that happened. So, you know, we dug into the investigation heavily. We talked to all the old cops. Chicago PD wouldn't touch us. I just flamethrow Chicago Police Department. Like, if you thought that they got hammered a little bit in Devil in Disguise, that's nothing compared to it. I lay waste to them because, again, I put obviously Gacy is the one whose hand was the one who committed the murders. But the fact is that he should have been in prison awaiting the death penalty at that point in time in 1973. And because of their indifference and their incompetence, That wasn't the case. So I put it on them. I put the blame on them for not doing the job. And it's like, you know, that thing where they were talking about, if you watch Devil in Disguise, oh, we couldn't communicate. Yeah, bullshit.
Right.
It's like nobody's buying it.
I'm curious because you had mentioned you think that he may have had property in Wisconsin. Do you know where he might have had property in Wisconsin?
We know of a location. One specific location that we know for a fact he was up there. I actually interviewed somebody on the podcast that considers themselves to have had a near death experience with Gacy. The kid was, it was up around Lake Delavan actually. And the kid was, his mom had told him to pull the boat out of the water, and Gacy was driving by. And, the thing with Gacy is nobody knew it was Gacy until Gacy was arrested.
Sure, he's just another guy.
Yeah, right. So, but like when the story breaks and his face is plastered all over the news, that's where you get tons of people like, oh my God, do you remember that story I told you about that weird creep? That's the guy, you know? Yeah. So we had so many people calling us, and because we had a number, we wanted to hear from people, because the other part of this thing, like I said, I was investigating the investigation, but I was also very much looking forward to the second season, in which we are going to do what no law enforcement agency ever did on that case, is look beyond the house in the river and look for other victims, because we just do not believe that there was a period of time of 2 years where Gacy was not killing, which is what they've always kind of laid their hat on in terms of the victims that they've been able to identify and being able to pinpoint when they went missing, and saying, oh, well, he was dormant during these two years of time. He wasn't. He was married to Carol from 72 to 76. And from 76 to 78, he went insane. And, you know, that was his most documented clear killing period, where he killed the most victims. And during this period of time that Carol was living there, he was just making other arrangements. I'm confident of it. We believe one of the properties that has, allegedly there's been a dig that they pretended like they did a dig. We call it a sham dig, which was the Miami and Elston property, where he was a handyman in a building in which his mother lived in, where my partner on it, Bill Dorsch, had interviewed all these people that lived in that apartment. And these interviews are unbelievable. They're like, yeah, he'd be there at like 2 a.m. He dig these like super long trenches, and he'd just leave them there for a couple of days. And then overnight he would come and fill them in, and there'd be like a 6-foot trench, and there'd be like one small bush. So Bill, prior to my podcast, had snuck onto the property and done LIDAR, gotten the machine out there.
Yeah.
And they found some abnormalities, which the person that was running the machine's like, you should dig here, and they were doing it all in the front yard. And so Bill just hounds and hounds and hounds of Cook County Sheriff's Police, goes to the media, trying to put pressure on them to conduct this dig. And they put up a little tent. They barricaded. As you can imagine, the press was massive. This is in 1994, shortly after Gacy was executed.
Yeah.
And so they put up this little tent. They invite the operator of the radar machine in there. And, they say, okay, well, where should we dig? He says, okay, well, you don't need to dig here. Looking at, his printout, he's like, and this is where I would dig. They say, okay, well, you can leave. And so for 15 minutes, they're in there by themselves. They come out with, like a nut and a bolt and like a plate. They're like, yeah, there's nothing. Show's over. Everybody go away. So, the significance is that Chicago doesn't want Gacy bodies. Chicago doesn't want potential liability for them not having done anything during the time that he was active. They have a vested interest in not finding any Gacy bodies. They put on a huge amount of pressure on anybody that is trying to continue the investigation. So but that's what we're doing. Like we are going to do, because there was no investigation if you think about when Rex Huterman was arrested. They immediately started looking into every possible place that he could have left victims behind. And that included Vegas, it included his brother's property down in South Carolina. They investigated it. With Gacy, that did not take place. All that took place, and by the time this thing went to trial, was trying to identify the kids that were in that crawl space and trying to find the five that he had claimed that he had thrown in the river. And that was it. There was no investigation beyond that. They just assumed that that's all there is, because that's where he put his bodies.
And they don't want, so it's another cover up. It's a cover up of not wanting exposure for incompetence, basically.
Right.
Or not doing their job. So there could very well be massive other chapters to this story that have not even been written yet because they haven't been discovered yet.
Yes. Yes. And you know, and I saw Steve, Steven had asked, he was tied to the Candyman. So there's that podcast that came out called the Clown and the Candyman. And the Candyman is Dean Corll, who was down in Texas, who was a serial killer, who had a almost identical modus operandi to Gacy in the sense that it was all young men. It was he had two accomplices, one of which ultimately shot and killed Dean Corll in 1973. I've seen them try to make the connections. There are many, many people out there that believe firmly that there was a network, a much larger network of child sex trafficking ring that existed back then, you know, because we had John David Norman in Chicago, who was infamous. He was finally arrested and they found that he had dossiers on thousands of kids from all around the country, from all around the Midwest in terms of prospects for these predators. Unfortunately, all of those files unbelievably were destroyed. And there was a connection between John David Norman and John Gacy. And that was this guy named Paskey, Philip Paskey. Philip Paskey had a relationship with two guys that I firmly believe were John Wayne Gacy's accomplices in 1976 through 78, and that was David Cram and Michael Rossi, two kids that worked for Gacy, somehow survived it, but also lived with Gacy in that house during his most active time where he was killing. They were also on record having admitted that they had dug the trenches. They had also found out after they arrested Gacy that Michael Rossi was driving around in Johnny Zick, who was one of Gacy's victims, another one of his employees that he killed, in John Zick's car for a fucking year.
Nobody really noticed this?
No one noticed anything.
Good God.
Crazy, dude. Like, that's what I'm saying. Like, the Peacock thing is wonderful. I thought in terms of finally kind of exposing just how terrifying Gacy was, it's great, but it really just scratches the surface. We go so much deeper, man. It's unbelievable. Yeah.
So much more in it. Buried is the podcast. You can get it wherever you get podcasts. And also Defense Diaries is Bob's podcast as well, and YouTube channel. You can find that wherever you get podcasts and on YouTube. Let's switch gears now. I want to talk about another case that we are both very passionate about and have been following out of Lono County, Arkansas. Aaron Spencer, the father accused of shooting the man he found with his 14-year-old daughter. He's now running for sheriff. And I think this is a lovely story. I mean, it's a horrible story, but it's a lovely way he is taking the ball and running with it and not being a victim to the system that's trying to run him off the road. Just like he ran off the road, the man who came into his house in the middle of the night, kidnapped his 14-year-old daughter, who he'd already essayed. And then finally, Aaron, he after he discovers his daughter's missing, catches up to him, drives him off the road, and kills him because he approaches him and he's attacking. So I think this is wonderful that Aaron Spencer is running for sheriff. Aaron Spencer also being charged with second-degree murder for the murder of that very predator. This is such a screwed-up story, and there's so many issues with it. And I'll say this. And this is what I was thinking earlier, because I just did another piece on this. What really gets me is the fact that Michael Fossler, the predator who has been killed in the shooting, the fact that he was released, the fact that the DA is going after dad who was protecting his daughter, which is only going to further traumatize that family, and the daughter who survived all of this stuff. Does anyone know anyone who protects predators other than predators?
No.
Nope.
I don't.
Next question.
Yeah, I think that answers a lot. I mean, I'm not saying anything, but I am kind of, I'm saying there needs to be a look at this, because I don't know anyone who is as passionately protecting a predator as the folks in Lono County are, who are doing this, who are going after Aaron Spencer as for second degree murder, and who let the guy out in the first place.
Well, and I think that's what they're protecting, aren't they? They're protecting the fact that they let this guy go for such a low amount of bail money and, oh, go do your thing. And he went and did his thing. And dad stepped in and became a hero. They're doubling down by charging
Spencer. And that's, to me, where I'm like, I don't know anybody who protects child predators other than other child predators.
Yeah. No,
I don't. I mean, prove me wrong, DA.
Yeah.
Prove me wrong. I'm not saying that DA is a child predator, but I am saying I don't know anyone who does protect them other than that. So it just seems a little weird.
It does, because that concept does not exist in the world.
No,
no normal person, no person that has children or cares about children or cares about people is going to protect somebody who's a known predator.
Yeah.
Like, it's inexplicable. Like, unless you yourself are a predator and you're terrified of exposure.
Yes.
You know,
and I mean, that's where my mind keeps going here.
Right. Well, and look, Tony and Stacy and I are not pointing fingers at anybody.
No.
Nope.
We're not.
However,
it
requires some kind of investigation, I would think.
Some critical thinking skills.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, as you said, Tony, we're both really passionate about this case. And when I found out that Aaron was running for sheriff and his wife had like sent me like the post, they had posted on Facebook first and I didn't see it in their group over there, which is 60,000 strong, which should tell you something.
Yes.
She's like, hey, I didn't know if you saw this, but I wanted you to see this. And I could not love it more than I do.
Mm-hmm. No. It's sticking it to the man, isn't it?
It's sticking it to the man. And you know, from the citizen's perspective, I love it. Mm-hmm. From the defense attorney's perspective, I love it, but it terrifies me, you know, mm-hmm. because, you know, the first thing is it adds another layer. It adds mm-hmm. another element to her job and their job as his defense attorneys in terms of navigating this. Now, this thing is set to go to trial early next year. I believe mm-hmm. it's early January. That election for sheriff is next November. So not this upcoming November, but next year. So John Staley, who's the current sheriff, is now putting up quite a bit of resistance. So you've got this issue wherein he's made a public announcement that he's running for office. You've got a longtime sheriff there who has been running around town saying, you don't know the whole story. You don't know the whole story. You're just listening to their narrative. So he's going to be trying to protect his office. He's going, you know, there's a lot at play here, and it's a really, really interesting angle. I am going to be taking a field trip to your neck of the woods, man, to visit down to Lone Oak, do some man on the street shit. Maybe I can talk you into meeting me over there, and we can talk to the people and see what the people have to say, because I get tired of hearing from politicians. I like to hear from the real ones, from the actual citizens of all these different places and all these stories that we hear about. And there's a lot going on with it. But I just think it's a fucking badass power move. It is flipping the script in a way that I just respect the hell out of.
Mm-hmm. Now, I want to understand this better about how the dynamics of this are working. So he's running for sheriff. The sheriff, the current one that is there, what sort of involvement did they have in this case to begin with? What are the legalities of running for sheriff when you might actually be indicted or imprisoned by the time you get elected? I mean, there's a lot of gray areas here. Let's start with the first part, though. What sort of involvement did this sheriff have in this, if any, to begin with the Michael Fossler and all of that when he was alive?
So his department, Staley's department, wasn't like the investigative agency. So like it really is in his case.
Okay, so, I didn't think so. Yeah,
he's sitting out there chirping about, you know, shit that he claims that he knows, trying to counter the narrative that is out there in terms of what actually happened. Like, and again, you have to ask yourself, what kind of fucking asshole is going to sit out there when it is known that Fossler was grooming and essaying this then 13-year-old girl and then is given a $5,000 bond by the very same judge who is sitting on Aaron Spencer's case?
Yeah.
Yes.
And Aaron Spencer didn't run out and kill Michael Fossler as soon as he bonded out. This is 3 months later.
Yeah, this is not a vigilante situation.
This is not a vigilante situation. 3 months later, this guy gets his filthy claws back in this kid. And again, I tell this to people all the time. If you don't if somebody asked me the question, well, how did she get in his car? I don't give a fuck.
Yep.
Exactly. I don't care.
Doesn't matter.
She was groomed. If you don't understand what grooming is, do a little research. Because when you have somebody in a position of authority and power and they get their hands into a child.
Correct.
With a child's mentality, and they develop this bond of trust, friendship, and then take it to the next level, that child is powerless to fight against it. And the fact that he was able to do it again, and we're talking, that's the guy, 67-year-old Uber creep who had his claws in this little girl.
Who had also been part of law enforcement.
In Indiana, he was law enforcement. This guy's ex-military. This guy is a guy who always positioned himself in a position of power. He always had a badge. He was always a ranking officer when he was in the National Guard. They transferred him to – I'm doing a lot of research on Michael Fossler.
Yeah.
I'm talking to a lot of people about Michael Fossler. I want to know what Michael Fossler was up to in Indiana. Because I'm going to get the narrative out of exactly who the fuck we're dealing with. And
this wasn't his only thing.
No. You don't start abusing children at 67.
No, it starts way earlier.
Way, way earlier.
Yeah. There's a wake, I'm sure, of victims in his past.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Stacey.
You'd be hard-pressed, I would think, to find a jury of your peers that's going to listen to this case from start to finish and go, oh, yeah, he's guilty of murder. He killed the guy. We need to put him away. No. He was a father. He was Papa Bear. He protected his daughter. Case closed. Don't you think, Bob? Am 100%. I oversimplifying this?
No, because it is that simple. But here's the thing. There's this thing that exists in the law, which they call jury nullification, okay? And that's where, you've got a jury. They hear a compelling story. Technically, there has been a violation of the law. Technically, that person is guilty of committing the crime. However, the jury is so compelled by the story and what actually happened that they decide not to apply the law. They don't follow the law. They call and they find the person not guilty. They acquit the person. They call that jury nullification. This isn't even that. This is if you look at the statute in Arkansas for defense of others, he had a reasonable belief and it was absolutely reasonable. If you don't think that this guy who had a stay away order, who had then after 3 months of being out, then continues to communicate with her immediately. And over the next 3 months, unbeknownst to the family, he's now texting her, sending her money, you know, and like getting his claws back into her. This guy doesn't give a fuck.
No.
He does not care. If you don't think as a father that the first thing that you're going to be thinking is one of two things, either he's kidnapping my child to get her because she is the only witness against him in the 43 counts that he has pending. Don't forget that. It's an important part of what's going on in Aaron Spencer's mind in the moment. And the other part that you'd be thinking is he's going to kill her because she's the only witness who can testify as to the assaults.
They're not going out for ice cream.
They are not going. And this is at 12:30 at night. This is at 12:30 at night. Okay.
Again, I don't know anyone that protects child predators other than child predators.
That's a great point.
Yes. So this is a situation wherein this isn't going to be jury nullification. They are going to find him not guilty.
Correct.
Because this was a justified homicide. Justified as yeah. long as the day is long.
Wouldn't this also even mean kind of go into take Hero Dad out of it, take Aaron Spencer out of it for a second, and go in the scenario that you're driving around. Let's say you're a friend of the family. You know that this guy had already violated this young girl, and you're driving. And you're like, holy shit, he's in the vehicle with that girl.
Yeah,
and you're just the good Samaritan. It's whoever is just driving around. You see this shit, and you're like, "Oh, holy fuck!" I mean, if I was out there, I think most dads, if you one of your friends' kids were in that situation, I'd be ramming him off the road too,
100%.
And I would also pull the trigger if I was armed and 100%. I saw this fucker. That's being a good Samaritan. Is that not you are protecting the life of yes. a child?
Yes.
Because the guy, it's not like Aaron Spencer didn't walk up to the truck and just pop the guy in the head. That's not what happened.
No.
Fossler approached him. You would think, well, let's see here. He's got my daughter in the truck. It's 12:30 at night. It's made to look at home like she just went out or that she was still in bed. This is all kind of a ruse to make it look like something else is going on. I find out she's missing and I get out there and there's this monster with my daughter. He approaches you. You're going to think he may be armed. He may yeah. not want me around.
Yeah.
If he's already done this, my life may be in danger. Certainly my daughter's is. Mine might be too. So, of course, if you're armed, you're going to use it.
Yes.
I do not understand what the hell is going on with these police, or with the DA, with the judge, with anything in Lono County that makes any of this make any gram of sense.
I wish I could give you an answer, but I can't. And I can tell you this, I'm going to certainly be trying to talk to the DA down there that's moving forward on these charges. Because I think that the people of the county of Lonoke want a fucking answer.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
You know, and not some bullshit. Oh, well, we have to let a jury. We have to
bullshit.
Let a jury.
This is not.
This ain't that. You know, this is not that situation. They have the ability to, as a district attorney, to look at it and make a decision as to whether or not they look at the facts as they exist and they say, okay, I'm either going to pull the trigger on this or I'm not. And
they can still back out.
They're elected too, T.
Yeah.
You know,
they are. And the DA yeah. can still drop charges. The DA can have an epiphany and go, maybe this is one I don't want to keep going with.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe it's one you don't want to keep going with again, because I don't know anyone who protects predators other than predators. And I don't think anyone else does either. So maybe it might be a good idea to back away from this one. Maybe just say, fucked up. Shouldn't.
I mean, they've had a fucking year.
And they still haven't. Well, then I guess we're going to have to let the world know who they are.
That's right. That's right. I mean, look, I mean, this thing is getting one of the beautiful things about him running. Is that got blasted all over. That shit went viral.
Yeah.
So the world knows about this case. It's mm-hmm. not just a few eyes on it. They got the eyes on the world on this case. And there's going to have to be answers that are going to have to be given by people that are going to have to be asked hard questions.
Yeah.
Because look, this thing, and the one thing that I want everybody to remember in terms of that statute, it's what would a reasonable person think in the moment in time? And again, this guy did not give a fuck. He had 43 pending charges for SA and other things all related to Aaron's daughter. He had a stay away order in place to stay away from not only that child, but the entire family and the property. Yeah. He did not care.
Yeah.
You have to try to have that, pretend that's running through your mind, that is what's going on in your head. Like, this fucking guy doesn't care.
Yeah.
Like that's where your brain's at. Because, like, a normal person, if they're out on bond, is not going to, even if they can't help themselves from committing another crime, say they're in for drug, you know, selling drugs. Well, I have to fucking make money. I'm out on bond. I'm going to hit the corner. I got to sell some rock because I have to eat. Uh-huh. That's a different thing. This is a guy who not only goes out and does it again, but does it with the same victim. This guy did not care at all. That is what's going through Aaron Spencer's mind when he rolls up on that truck and he's screaming for his daughter to get out of the cab of the truck. She's not coming. And he's saying, he's yelling at Foster, let my fucking daughter go. Let my daughter out of the truck, screaming at the top of his lungs. Yeah. And instead Foster gets out.
Yeah.
The shit from right there. In my estimation, it's over. You know, like you.
I'm ready to pull the trigger the second he walks out. Right, I mean, like, what's going to happen there? Like, oh, hey, I just wanted to take her out to the DQ, get a blizzard or something, and just make up for everything and say it was all a big misunderstanding. Bull fucking shit. I mean, it's like this is just. And here's another element to the case because it keeps getting darker and darker. And it's important that anyone who is hearing this and getting enraged get fully enraged and understand what the hell's going on here. Let's talk about the gag order on this case that was there for how long that immediately was like, nobody can talk about any of this shit. Give us some insight on that, Bob.
Yeah. So the gag order, and again, the important part of this puzzle of this gag order is that, again, you're dealing with the same judge who granted a $5,000 bond cash had to be posted for him to be able to walk out on 43 counts, including multiple counts of SA against a minor.
Yeah.
Okay. In our state, you're doing life on that shit. Mm-hmm. Okay. So
in Florida, they can kill you now.
Right.
So what happens is after he gets out, this thing goes down, and lo and behold, the judge presiding over Aaron Spencer's case is the exact same fucking judge, exact same woman. Okay. So one of the first things she does is there. And I highly recommend everybody go and watch the argument in that case because it was broadcast in the Arkansas Supreme Court. So Aaron's attorneys went and said, okay, this gag is fucking ridiculous. They've gagged the world. For some reason, this judge is trying to allow the world not to speak about the case at all. Mm-hmm. No one can speak about it. It was the most far-reaching gag you can ever see, right?
Matter of fact, protecting something, are we?
Here we are.
So ultimately, they file. It gets up to the Supreme Court of Arkansas. The Supreme Court, like, this gag is absurd. I've never seen anything like this. We're flamethrowing the gag. The gag is done. One of the concurring justices who didn't write the opinion, because the majority wrote the opinion, and then one, you know, other justices can say, hey, I want to write something too, because I got thoughts and feelings about this. This judge says, you know, when they looked at how this thing went down from when the state filed the motion requesting the gag, okay, they said that she turned around quicker, like he used this language. He said she granted the state's motion without the defense being able to file a responsive pleading. She granted that motion faster than it takes to brew a cup of what do they call those things? Pot of coffee.
Okay. Bob, I'm so curious. Bob, you might need some coffee, dude.
I know. I mean,
we're striving for the word pot of coffee today, Bob.
I'm worried about you.
I'm a Keurig guy, so it's always cups now.
It's a pot.
Yeah, I haven't used a pot in forever.
True.
But that's incredibly telling because it's basically they're saying, look, you turned around immediately and granted this thing without even doing any research. And then on top of it, you use a gag order from a case that we had previously overturned. So you used a cut and paste for your gag order for a gag that has been declared bad law. So that justice not only said, shame on you, but what I suggest is we use our power to remove that judge from that case. Unfortunately, that judge was a concurring judge, so it didn't have the strength that the actual opinion has, wherein when you get the opinion in the appellate courts or the Supreme Court said, okay, this is what's happening, it's got to be in the majority opinion. So concurring opinions, you can't employ the things that they're asking them to do. They're just allowed to say, this is what should have been done. This is what I think that my brethren should have done in the majority opinion. So you had at least one judge saying, this fucking judge should never have been sitting on Aaron Spencer's case. She's got to go, which I still think she needs to go. You know, yeah. How she's sitting on this case, how there's no conflict there is beyond
that. That should be the big thing that they're going after.
Well, I mean, there's going to be a gazillion appellate issues. I mean, right. I mean, we shouldn't even have to go through this. This family's been traumatized by a predator, and the judge and the DA are like, let's traumatize them again. Why?
And the child.
Why? Again, I don't know anyone who protects child predators other than child predators. And I'm not saying any of them are. But I'm saying I don't know anyone.
Begs the question.
And we'll end on that. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on YouTube. If you're not already there, search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there. Bob's podcast, Defense Diaries, check it out. And also, of course, Buried, search for that. That is available right now as well, wherever you get podcasts. This is, let me pull the graphic up for that again one more time. Inside the John Wayne Gacy Investigation, Buried, check that out right now to get all of that. It's great stuff. Bob, as always, thanks for being here.
For Stacy,
I love you too. For Stacy, for Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's.
Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
There we go.